Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 80. And tonight we have a special guest. Dr. Charles Ferguson is a policy analyst with the Council on Foreign Relations, and his specialty is security studies, particularly done a lot of work in nuclear nonproliferation. So welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Rod. It's great to be on the show.
Yeah, glad to have you on board, particularly since you've just done some recent traveling that is gives us a timely ability to talk about India and the U.S.'s potential agreements with India and maybe some of the history as to why India is treated so much differently than so many other countries with regard to nuclear energy and nuclear power technologies.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. And also, about 6 months ago, I made a quick trip to Japan and was able to visit some nuclear sites there. I went to Rokkasho, where they have the reprocessing plant that's soon to go into full operation. And I also visited Manju, where they have their fast reactor facility. And I happened to be there the very day, August 31st last year, when they were testing the secondary part of the plant. And about 12 years ago, they had a sodium leak, not in the primary part of the plant, the radioactive part of the plant, but they had the leak in the secondary non-radioactive part of the plant. And the Japanese, being very cautious, they have been testing that reactor very thoroughly for the last 12 years. And they think sometime later this year, if they can get support from the local populace, they will try to bring the reactor critical again and try to bring it up to full-scale operations.
So the Manju accident, if I remember correctly, this is scraping some dim rust off my brain. I didn't prepare for this one. Wasn't that a steam leak that actually was ended up to be fatal?
What happened was that they had been operating a reactor for a very short period of time. I'm trying to call exact date they brought it up. I think it was August of 1995. And they had been operating a reactor, I think, just for about 3 or 4 months. And what happened was a thermometer probe had work hardened, and the sodium flow past the thermometer kept vibrating back and forth over a period of a few months. And then finally it snapped, the thermometer. And so that allowed just enough of a gap for some of that liquid sodium to go through the out through that crack in the piping, and it hit air, ignite, caused some fire. It wasn't a huge amount of damage, and it basically made sodium bicarbonate, and so they had to that's a cleanup, and they shut down the reactor. But there was really no danger at any point of any kind of radioactivity release. It didn't affect accident or incident didn't affect any part of the nuclear part of that power plant system. It was in the secondary heat exchange part. And so they showed me all the mock-ups of the old thermometer, and they designed a brand new type of thermometer that they believe will not be affected by work hardening because of the sodium coolant flow. And they're confident they fixed that problem. And they're being very careful. So they're going through every single system and subsystem to make sure everything is going to work just right. And the Japanese believe that they will not operate a nuclear reactor system without support from the local populace. So they've also been trying to educate the local people in the Manju area that the reactor is safe. And they said to me that, honestly, they've been struggling with that education effort because a lot of poor fisherfolk live there, don't know much about nuclear issues, don't know much about radiation. And it's been a struggle to get public acceptance there, but they think that they eventually will win the public over.
Did they try to bribe?
Well, I guess in a way, yeah, the bribes do happen there. So I did ask that question, and maybe not that directly to my Japanese colleagues. You know, you're talking to Japanese, you got to be kind of careful how you phrase questions. And I said, well, are there any kind of incentives that you can offer people? And then they were more blunt than answering me. And I said, well, often what happens is the local governments say, sure, we'll make sure you have public support for your nuclear power plant. What we need new schools, or we need new roads, or, you know, it's basically kind of a quid pro quo going on there, and you know, sort of like a social welfare system.
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting that we people have this idea that nuclear has a difficult time with public acceptance in the local area. But it's an industry. Like any other industry, people will say, what's in it for me? Why should I allow this to happen in my local area? And if people
right.
view it as a benefit in terms of providing jobs or roads or schools or whatever, the resistance is much less. And in fact,
yeah.
in the U.S., I think the surveys would tell you that the closer you get to nuclear reactors, the more supportive the local population is of them.
Yes. That's right.
I mean, whenever there are protests these days at operating reactors, you have to import the protesters. You don't find them from
right.
local areas.
Yeah.
Sometimes you find some that are living in local areas, but you realize that they've only been there for a few years, so they moved there after the plant was there.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and I don't realize that you can live next to the plant for many decades, and you're not going to be receiving any excess radiation that you wouldn't have received anywhere else. And
right.
If you go out, live out in the Rocky Mountains, you're going to be exposed to a lot more excess radiation than you would next to a nuclear plant at sea level.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
the contribution of nuclear reactors to their local population in terms of radioactivity is essentially not measurable.
Right. Actually, I teach this course at Georgetown University, and 2 weeks ago I was showing students the data on this and natural radiation sources and artificial man-made sources. And I said, then you get to the nuclear fuel cycle, and it's something like 0.0002 millisievert per year. You know, it's a very, very tiny amount from the whole fuel cycle.
Right. And
yeah.
based on my understanding of the measuring devices, it's not measurable. But you have,
right.
to,
it's so
you have
down
to compute it. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Right.
Yes. Yeah, and just to give, I didn't mention this when I introduced you, but for the listeners, Dr. Ferguson's doctor is a doctor in physics from Boston University, PhD in physics.
Right,
and,
not nuclear physics, though. I studied earthquake simulations and condensed matter physics, but my nuclear training is in the nuclear Navy.
And your nuclear training was, I guess you got a physics degree from the Naval Academy, and then you went on to nuclear power school.
Right,
but,
Orlando, Florida, right, and
mm-hmm.
Prototype training in Connecticut.
Ah, so you went to the little prototype there.
Yes, S1C.
Combustion engineering, yes. 20 megawatt thermal or something like that.
Right, turbo electric plant, as I recall. So it's a pretty unique reactor. I don't know. I don't think it's operating anymore. I think it's shut down now.
No. Yeah. It was a prototype for the Tullaby.
That's right, yeah.
Which was a tiny little... we called it an appendage to a dock because it almost never went to sea. It was a one-of-a-kind ship, and it's always hard to keep one-of-a-kind ships operating. So the Tullaby was built under somebody's idea of building a very small, inexpensive submarine, and it didn't turn out quite as inexpensive as one might think because it was
mm-hmm,
a first-of-a-kind.
Right. Yeah.
So
got to get those economies of scale going. So.
Well, you know, yeah, it's economies of scale, but, you know, a lot of people misunderstand that word. Economies of scale doesn't mean build the biggest possible thing you can build.
No, right. It's, you know, trying to great, not do what we basically did in the United States, because we have 104 commercial reactors. And the old joke, and maybe some of your guests in earlier shows have said this, comparing France to the United States. In France, you have 100 different types of cheese, but only really a couple of different types of reactor designs that the French have copied over 59 or so reactors.
Right.
Where in the United States, we have around 100 reactors, and they're all pretty much unique in terms of how they were licensed and designed and sited. And we only have really a couple kinds of cheese here. So.
Well, now that's really an oversimplification, because I've been to gourmet cheese shops, and we have a lot of cheese. We just
right.
don't we just don't sell it at Walmart. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, the American cheese economy is quite healthy these days. And even our wine economy is pretty good.
And microbreweries as well. So it's
exactly.
not just Budweiser anymore. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But of course, one of the things the lessons that the nuclear industry has learned is that they need to work on less designs, although there's still, some people will say, well, geez, there's still 5 designs being toyed with these days, but most of the people or most of the companies are talking about selling fleets of those designs, you know. Unistar wants to have a fleet of reactors that are so similar that you can go into the men's head and feel like you're at the same reactor as you were when you just left the one across the country.
That's right. Yeah, and I think if they can do that, you know, help drive down some of these high capital costs.
Yeah. Well, yeah, things have changed a lot. Back in the days when the first reactors were built in the U.S. was a time when all electric utilities felt like they had to have a lot of input into the designs of all their power plants. They had a big engineering staff, and you know, they did the same thing with their coal plants they did with their nuclear plants. They had, you know, specific criteria for various sites, and some sites had good water, so they used a once-through cooling, and other sites had no water, so they had to have cooling towers, and some sites had earthquake problems and other sites didn't. So,
yeah.
You know, there's lots of variations in the theme. And, of course, the vendors, you know, they kept coming up with new ideas because it was a new technology, and they always figured that they can make more money if they sell more parts.
That's right, yeah.
So, and of course...
Right, and different licensing processes, too, as well. Yeah.
Right. Well, you could license the construction without having a complete design at that time, and
then you have to apply for the operating license, and that can take some years, depending on the various hoops you had to go through.
Right. Yep. So let's go back and talk a little bit about India.
Yes.
India is, of course, the world's largest democracy, and the U.S. has had some iffy relations with India for many years. We like them sometimes, and we don't like them other times, and one of the things that I guess really soured our relationship with India was an event back in 1974 when the Indians became a new nuclear power by exploding a test device in their desert areas.
They call it a PNE, a peaceful nuclear explosive. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one man's PNE is another man's nuclear weapon.
Well, of course, it really wasn't a weapon. It wasn't something that could be delivered.
And it's fair to point out that under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which India never signed, but still, I think it's Article 5 of the treaty, says that countries were entitled to using peaceful nuclear explosives.
Right.
Even we explored using nuclear explosives to drill for natural gas and maybe, you know, dig canals and things of that sort. But all those applications had been abandoned.
Actually, in 1974, we were still looking at them.
Yeah, at that point, right. But at least today, I don't think we're seriously looking at those.
No, but at the time that the Indians did their peaceful nuclear explosive, we still had the Plowshares program operating. And we, in fact, did more than just talk about it. We did explode at least one that I know of in Colorado in a natural gas field, because it was a tight natural gas field is what they called it. A place where we knew there was gas, but there weren't enough fissures in the rock to allow the gas to travel to convenient wells. So there was a nuclear explosive exploded, and I can't remember exactly where it was in Colorado. But
yeah, I'm trying to remember. Actually, a couple years ago, I saw a film that had a film clip about that event.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it was too bad that the natural gas became radioactive, but it did free up apparently a lot of gas by doing an explosive.
Interestingly enough, the natural gas did become radioactive, but it was short-lived radioactivity.
Uh-huh.
And I think I read within the last year or so that that particular area is now being exploited for commercial natural gas. They finally allowed drilling in the area after testing and realizing that the radioactivity levels were back to less than what, or the same as what natural gas normally is, which normally, although people don't realize this,
there's some radioactivity in it, yeah.
Correct, because you have naturally occurring radioactive materials, and some of them decay into gaseous products like radon.
Yep.
So, yeah, natural gas does have a little bit of radiation involved in it. People talk a lot about the radiation in coal, but very few people mention that part. Hey, what do the Indian people think about the nuclear program? You mentioned in your email to me that you had some insight on that matter.
Well, are you referring to the weapons program or the nuclear power program?
Kind of both.
Okay. So my sense, talking to Indian colleagues there and reading about the Indian people's views of the nuclear strategic program, the weapons program, is they generally look on it as a status symbol. I really know very few Indian colleagues who are vehemently opposed to India having acquired that capability. Even colleagues who are supportive of nuclear disarmament say they understand why the government decided to test nuclear devices and to at least establish India as a nuclear-armed state. There were security concerns. They pointed in Pakistan. Also, they pointed to China. But I think really it came down to India trying to achieve its place in the world, or figuring out a way for it to try to achieve its what it considers its rightful place in the world. And as you pointed out, India is the largest democracy in the world, and they have now more than 1 billion people. And for decades, they've been trying to get a permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council. And it's not lost on anyone that the five countries on the UN Security Council that have veto power are the five legally recognized nuclear weapon states: the United States, Russia, China, Britain, and France. Now, there's nothing in the UN Charter that says in order to have a permanent seat on the UN Security Council, you must be a nuclear weapon state. But it's because of historical artifact, conquering the victorious powers after World War II happened to be those countries, and those happened to be the countries that were in the right position in terms of their industry and their security needs to develop nuclear weapons before anyone else. And they tested nuclear devices before the cutoff date in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, cutoff date being January 1st, 1967. So you mentioned, yes, India tested a nuclear device in 1974, and that was 7 years after the cutoff date. So they missed the due date, but so now what is India? Is it a nuclear weapon state? Well, technically, no, not in terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but India never signed the treaty. So did India violate international law by developing nuclear weapons? Well, technically, no. But what's the United States' role in this? Well, because we are one of the biggest promoters of non-proliferation, we're trying to hold the line on new countries developing nuclear weapons. So when India went ahead and did this test back in the 1970s, we went ahead and tried to impose sanctions, tried to cut off nuclear supplies to India. So any aspects of their nuclear program, whether it's in the weapons side or in the peaceful energy side, was suspect because the Indians had used plutonium from a research reactor that they had acquired from Canada, and they acquired some other materials, a heavy water from the United States for that reactor. So we would say, well, they violated a safeguards agreement they had for that reactor. Indians have a different interpretation of that. Well, that's kind of water over the dam. So what happened was, for more than 30 years, we had essentially an embargo on India receiving nuclear technologies. And 3 years ago, President Bush signed an agreement with Prime Minister Manmohan Singh to establish what's called the India-U.S. nuclear deal, in which the United States is trying to bring India out of the cold, so to speak, and carve out an exception and the nuclear supply rules to allow India to receive nuclear technologies from external suppliers and basically open up India's market for nuclear energy development. And the exchange was that India would designate a certain number of its civilian reactors as subject to safeguards, monitoring by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And the deal that people thought India agreed to was that those reactors would be placed under permanent safeguards. India has been refusing so far to allow that kind of permanent safeguards being placed in those reactors. Indians are concerned that if that happens and the overall commercial deal falls through, that India will have accepted a so-called burden by placing those reactors under safeguards, and they might not receive the goods they want in exchange. So right now, the Indian government and the IAEA are negotiating over what's called India-specific safeguards on those reactors. And when talking to Indian colleagues, they generally would like India to be treated like France or Britain and be subject to voluntary safeguards. And because India is considered a non-nuclear weapon state under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, it can't be subject to those safeguards. And instead, the only safeguards allowed to it are these facility-specific safeguards. So you designate a certain reactor, processing plant, certain facility, as subject to safeguards by the IAEA. And the way that safeguards agreement was written back in the 1960s, that's a permanent agreement on that facility.
Have the weapons powers adhered to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty?
I think I know what you're driving at in that question. Have they lived up to all the terms of the treaty? The governments of the hosts of the nuclear weapon powers would say yes, they are. I mean, I'm referring to Article 6 in the treaty, which calls on the legal nuclear weapon states to pursue nuclear disarmament in a treaty on general disarmament. Now, it doesn't say when this is supposed to take place, and it does say pursue, so this is open to interpretation. So teams of lawyers have pondered over that article, and those who are very favorable toward nuclear disarmament would say, well, unless the United States is committed to driving down to zero nuclear weapons, they're not living up to the terms of the treaty. The U.S. government likes to say, well, look where we were during the Cold War. Go back to the mid-1980s when we were reaching a peak in, I think the Soviet Union had more of a peak of warheads at that point. But you think back to the time at the height of the Cold War when we had 30,000 or so warheads, and now we're down to less than 10,000. And even President Bush a few months ago was saying, let's go down even lower to about 5,000 total warheads. And by 2012, when the Treaty of Moscow is going to expire, we should be down to that level, or probably even sooner than that, based on current projections. So in that respect, it looks like, in terms of pure warhead numbers, we have made a huge reduction. But is it enough? Is the actual number of warheads a thing we should be worried about, or instead is it the actual nuclear weapons policies? Are we relying on nuclear weapons too much for security, or should we just rely on them for core nuclear deterrence, that is, just deterring other countries' nuclear weapons, and that's the only purpose these nuclear weapons serve. And so there's now a debate going on, and it got stimulated about a year ago in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. Four wise men of foreign policy, two Republicans, two Democrats, Henry Kissinger and George Shultz on the Republican side, and Sam Nunn and Bill Perry on the Democratic side, put their names to an op-ed that was titled A World Free of Nuclear Weapons, I think, was the title. And they just a week or so ago published a follow-on op-ed with a similar theme. That has stimulated a lot of discussion among my circles in nuclear security. And one of my colleagues counts probably about a dozen organizations in the Washington area that are doing studies now reevaluating U.S. nuclear weapons policy, in part stimulated because of the so-called Gang of Four op-ed in the Wall Street Journal.
Hmm. Very interesting. So what do you think is the most dangerous number of nuclear weapons, and what is the most dangerous number of countries to have nuclear weapons?
Well, it's hard to say. I think if you're talking about the United States and Russia, you know, back in the Cold War, we had some close calls, but now we're no longer enemies. I wouldn't say we're bosom buddies with Russia, and we've had some hard times with them recently. And so you know, there's still a danger of potential nuclear war between the United States and Russia. I don't think it's due to direct threat. I don't think President of the United States or the Russian president would seriously try to initiate any kind of nuclear war, but I'm concerned it may happen by accident. And so there's still that possibility. I'm not saying it's likely to happen. I think it's extremely unlikely, but I think because the consequences are so huge, I think there's more we can do to ratchet down the number of weapons. But the threat that really worries me the most, and here I'll plug a book I wrote a few years ago. I co-authored a book with a former boss. The book's called The Four Faces of Nuclear Terrorism. And in that book, we looked at could terrorists actually acquire nuclear weapons from an arsenal and detonate them? Or could terrorists acquire enough fissile material, make their own improvised nuclear device, and blow it up? And both of those threats, two of the so-called faces we look at in the book, the other two faces involve radiological terrorism. But if you just look at pure nuclear terrorism, sure, it's not very likely to happen, but the consequences are so huge, and they could so change civilization as we know it, that I think we should be doing a lot more than we already are in securing nuclear weapons and nuclear materials that could be used in those weapons. And we have been doing a tremendous amount of work, especially with Russia, in converting old warhead material into megatons to megawatts program into nuclear fuel. And maybe this was covered in an earlier episode on your program, but half of the nuclear fuel we used in this country right now is coming from old Russian nuclear warheads. This is really swords in the plowshares. And so on average, 1 in 10 light bulbs in this country is being fueled by an old Russian nuclear warhead.
Yeah, and that's been
pretty
true.
Amazing.
That's been true for about the last 10 years.
And we got another, I think, 5 or 6 years left on that deal. And then it's up in the air whether it's going to be renewed or not.
So in essence, a whole year's worth of U.S. electricity already has come from Russian warheads.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's the legacy of the Cold War actually providing benefits to Americans. Yeah.
And there's a whole lot of that material left to still be used.
That's right.
I know the agreement only lasts another 5 years or so, but part of that is a commercial limitation. When that agreement was signed, there was a lot of concern over what it was going to do to the overall uranium market and market for separative work units and all that other neat stuff. So when it comes to India, what is the U.S.'s strength as a negotiator in a world where France and Russia are quite willing to step in and supply if we don't?
Yeah, and one of the problems we face is a legal hurdle And I'm not a lawyer, but a friend of mine who is an attorney who knows nuclear law says that we need to get India and the United States signed up to the same liability convention. So we have our workers over there helping to build a nuclear power plant. Some kind of accident happens. We want to make sure there's full liability coverage. So that's one barrier that's faced, and the Russians don't quite have that legal issue to deal with, and I don't quite know where the French stand in terms of that liability convention. But then, because right now in the United States we don't have the kind of construction capabilities for making the reactor pressure vessels and the other critical parts you need, in contrast, France and Russia are better suited to do those kind of jobs. France and Russia are a little more nimble in terms of moving into those kind of markets like India. Mm-hmm. So what if it turns out that the deal goes through and some foreign reactors get built in India and none of them have the Made in USA label on them? Is that a failure for the United States? And I would say no. I think we need to look at the broader picture here. We need to look at our larger relationship with India. And here, now I've been with the Council for Relations for a few years and getting a political science education. I think it's much more than about nuclear energy or nuclear security. It's about our relationship with a country that I think can become an important ally and certainly a natural friend, because we're the oldest democracy and they're the largest democracy. And, I think Indians and Americans tend to get along very well together. And also India has, especially in the educated classes, they speak English.
We have a lot of phone conversations with Indians.
I know. Well, I had problems with my Dell computer last year. And so, I call the helpline and I get a guy called Vincent, and I know he's in Bangalore.
Right.
And actually funny, when I was in Delhi a few weeks ago, my wife and I were doing some shopping and this young man came up to me, heard my American accent and wanted to talk with me. And he had an American accent too, but he had never left India. And he worked at one of the call centers and mm-hmm. he's on his way up. So that's just a stepping stone.
Right.
And I think that's indicative of a lot of Indians, why they see themselves.
Right.
They see their country.
Yep. Hey, let's shift on to another thing. You mentioned the radiological terrorist threat. I guess you're talking about so-called dirty bombs.
Dirty bombs, right.
A lot of people get really scared about these things. Should we?
I think we need to put it in proper perspective. I think it's probably the most important thing that people should understand first is what a so-called dirty bomb is not. It is not a nuclear weapon. You cannot get an explosive chain reaction out of the radioactive material that you would find in a typical dirty bomb. And I think dirty bomb, unfortunately, that term has caught on with the news media. And I say unfortunately because it's a bit of a misnomer and it gives the wrong impression. It gives the impression you must use conventional explosives to disperse radioactive material to create contamination or maybe try to create some kind of health effects. And speaking of health effects, people should keep in mind for most radiological weapon scenarios, the health effects from radiation are going to be pretty low. Probably most people aren't going to receive any kind of significant contamination of any people, and especially in terms of immediate health effects. Still, we have a lot of work to do in educating the public about the real risk and the perceived risk. And I think when people hear the word radiation, they might assume the worst. And I think the first thing we who are educated in nuclear issues should tell the public is, first thing, don't panic. It's usually not immediately life-threatening. If you're not right next, if it really, literally is a dirty bomb and a conventional blast is used, and you're right next to the bomb, you may be hurt or maybe killed because of the bomb blast, but not because of the radiation, typically. So you have to keep that in mind. And then you have to realize that not all radioactive substances are alike. And there are really only about 10 radioactive isotopes, nuclides, that really pose a significant security concern if they're present in relatively large amounts. And so things like cesium-137, cobalt-60, strontium-90, et cetera, are a few of the isotopes of concern. But even those isotopes are typically used in relatively small amounts in radioactive sources. It's estimated there are millions of radioactive sources in use in the world every day. And of those millions, only a small fraction are truly in the high-risk category from a security perspective. But still, that small fraction constitutes something on the order of several thousand, maybe a few tens of thousands of sources. In our country, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been trying to establish a registry in the last few years to track these high-risk sources. And so far, I think they've been able to identify about 3,000 or so sources that are in the upper risk categories. And so it may seem like a lot, but we have a big country, and there are a lot of blood banks and hospitals and universities that do have some of these powerful sources.
And oil companies.
And oil companies, that's right. Oil well logging sources, radiography sources used to check pipe welds. And I've actually taken part in U.S. government studies looking at the use of certain types of radioactive sources in and around the Baltimore-Washington area. And I won't name specific places we've been to, but you know, a lot of hospitals, universities, and places like that people frequently visit, and they probably have no idea there are radioactive sources on that property, and those radioactive sources are very well shielded. And what's interesting is that those radioactive sources with a lot of radioactivity, which might be sort of the holy grail for a radiological terrorist, can be pretty difficult to move. These things can weigh several hundred pounds because a lot of the lead shielding and metal casing. You would have to really know what you're doing to break into that device to safely extract the radioactive source without harming yourself or potentially killing yourself.
And they're really easy to find.
Right. Actually, the funny thing, I was trying to take some of my colleagues in the National Lab to visit one of these sites, and I called in advance the colleague there at the university, and she said, "We're located over here." And we wandered around for several minutes just trying to find, one, her office, and then trying to find where the radioactive source is located. So, you know, even people who are so-called experts in the field, you know, have a hard time really finding out where the radioactive sources are.
Yeah, but if somebody had stolen a radioactive source and was somehow trying to move it, maybe by not shielding it because it was lighter to move it that way, they would be pretty easy to find.
Right, exactly.
You wouldn't be able to find them looking, but somebody with a device.
Exactly, they'd be kind of lit up, so to speak.
I mean, there's a lot of sensors that can find kinds of radioactive sources that are hazards to human health are pretty easy to find because they send out beacons on a regular basis with a measurable half-life.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're right. That's the fingerprint. You know what that source, that isotope is.
Yeah. And it seems to me that sometimes, and I got to be honest with you, I have a bit of a beef with the non-proliferation community, because so many of the conservative approaches that they suggest, what they do is really add tremendous costs and burden to the use of nuclear materials to the point where some people avoid them. You know, hospitals in many places have shut down their nuclear medicine facilities because it's simply too hard to do everything that people ask them to do. There are some tremendous, really cool reactor designs that need uranium or plutonium that is more enriched than what is considered to be low-enriched uranium. And those designs are kept off-limits because of the concerns about proliferation. And to me, in a world where there's tens of thousands of warheads still, it doesn't quite make much sense.
Could you? What about a compromise in which only a small number of facilities that have security around it could share? You know, scientists could go there and do joint research and they could work on these highly enriched uranium reactors.
I'm not talking about
in the world.
I'm not talking about research. I'm talking about operations. I'm talking about small reactors that can be used all over the world in distributed locations. You know from your own experience that if you want to build a real small reactor, you need to use enriched uranium.
It certainly helps. You can make a very compact reactor, and now the nuclear submarines in the U.S. it's weapons grade material and it's lifetime core, so you don't have to refuel.
Yeah,
to keep this right.
I mean, there are applications that are could be very useful. Could do things that might even save the world by reducing our dependence on fossil fuels for things that we all assume have to use fossil fuels today, like driving surface ships around or maybe even providing power to trains that would be enabled by using more compact reactors.
What about concerns that terrorists could target the transports of HEU to these reactors? And I'm not saying it's a likely scenario, but if enough of that material falls into terrorist hands, they might be able to make a simple gun-type improvised nuclear device.
Well, that's true if you were moving the HEU in raw form, but you mentioned lifetime cores.
Right.
Imagine a situation where there were half a dozen or so manufacturers of lifetime cores for small reactors. And the way you move them was a core, shielded core, from the factory to wherever it needs to go.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Once that reactor operates, it pretty well self-protects.
Okay. Let's follow the life cycle of the HEU. So then, you have to produce that at an enrichment plant.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of measures will we need to make sure there won't be an insider theft of HEU from the enrichment plant?
We have enrichment plants operating today with those kinds of measures, and you don't need very many to produce the kinds of materials that we are talking about. I mean, at one time, the U.S. built 41 submarines in... 4 years, 5 years, all with those kinds of reactors.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, we're not talking about a large, transportation of unprotected sources.
Yeah, it's, as you may know, if you've looked at any of my writings, I do come from that crowd that has expressed concerns about commerce and HEU, the continued use of highly enriched uranium. But listening to you, I mean, I think I do understand where you're coming from. And I also will point out that South Africa has a similar point of view. South Africa dismantled its nuclear weapons program, and it was fueled by highly enriched uranium. And they did not give up the HEU. They placed it under international safeguards.
Mm-hmm.
And they view that HEU as a strategic resource, not in the sense of a strategic weapons program, but as a strategic resource to make isotopes and things of that sort.
Right.
So they don't want to give it up. They are now feeling pressure from the United States and other Western governments to take steps to give up that HEU. And the South African government says, just as you said, Rod, a little while ago, well, wait a minute. So you're worried about our 600 kilos of HEU when you, United States, and you, Russia, and you, France, you have tons of the stuff. And so, why don't you take more steps to secure or get rid of your stuff, get down at our level, and then we'll talk. They said it's kind of silly that you have all these nuclear weapons and you're worried about our HEU that we want to use for peaceful purposes. So, and South Africa stands on the moral authority of being the only country in the world to have dismantled its nuclear weapons program.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm learning about their perspective, and I think that's one of the reasons why I try to keep an open mind, and that's why I love not just talking to people here in the United States like you, but going different parts of the world, going, you know, India, getting back to the Indian issue and learning from Indian colleagues about their point of view. Mm-hmm. It's pretty unique. And it's not that I think they're in love with nuclear weapons, but they're very proud of their accomplishments. And they have this vision of a three-part nuclear program. And they're just really now in the first phase going into the second phase. The third phase will involve thorium. So I should back up and say that the first phase would use the limited indigenous uranium in India to fuel pressurized heavy water reactors, and those reactors would produce plutonium. Indians would take that plutonium and use it to fuel breeder reactors. Those breeder reactors would make even more plutonium. Then they could use that to fuel help fuel the thorium cycle. India is sitting on a huge amount of thorium 232, which is not fissile, but it's fertile, so you can make fissile stuff with thorium, and it can make uranium-233 with that. And they have an estimated amount of thorium that could last potentially hundreds of years, maybe 1,000 years worth of power, depending on what the energy demands are.
Right.
So, and they're holding fast to that vision, despite the fact that American experts like me tell them, why are you doing plutonium reprocessing? Why are you separating out plutonium? That's dangerous stuff. If terrorists got their hands on that, if that stuff got loose, we can have a real catastrophe on our hands.
And so the answer is, we don't let terrorists get it.
Right. And they said, well, we're keeping it secure. We know that. We are committed to this nuclear energy program, outlining these three phases. So, you know, you can just tell countries, do this, do this, do this, and if they have a different vision, they'll continue following that vision unless they find some other reason not to do it, and they find something else that's a greater benefit, or at least perceived benefit.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the U.S., one of the reactor designs that I really like that uses highly enriched uranium as part of the design is a seed and blanket design that we in the U.S. actually were able to create a breeder reactor in a light water reactor because we used seed and blanket design. And that was the last core of the shipping port reactor was the light water breeder reactor. And it used, I think it used highly enriched uranium and thorium as the fuel source, and was able to show a breeding ratio slightly greater than one.
Interesting.
So that, you know, there are, and plutonium, you talk about South Africa and their HEU resource is very similar to the way the Japanese describe their plutonium resource.
That's right, yeah.
Because they have tons of separated plutonium that is ready to be used for either MOX or other types of reactors.
Right.
Know. Plutonium being a fissile material, and even a fissile material with a slightly better production ratio of neutrons than uranium-235, it's very valuable.
That's right.
And not to be buried underground in glass logs.
Because non-proliferation experts, especially the American non-proliferation experts, go to Japanese colleagues and say, plutonium reprocessing is more expensive than the once-through uranium fuel cycle. Why pay the extra cost? And the Japanese said, we're willing to pay the extra cost. In fact, if you look at the extra amount in terms of electricity charge for nuclear-generated electricity in Japan, it goes up, I think it's about 10% additional cost because of the reprocessing plant. And so they think that 10% is worth paying in order to try to move to an era where they would eventually use this plutonium and they would think have greater energy security because they wouldn't be as reliant on external supplies of uranium because they have very little indigenous uranium.
Right. And the other thing is, when people compare the cost of recycled fuel to the cost of fuel using virgin materials, they want to compare, again, recycled nuclear fuel to virgin nuclear fuel. But recycled nuclear fuel is still far cheaper on a per unit heat basis than natural gas or coal is.
Right. And that, yeah, and I wanted to ask you, so how do we deal with the large construction costs of nuclear? Because, right, on a if you look at fuel basis, coal, natural gas, nuclear fuel is cheaper. Mm-hmm. But we have the huge construction cost, and we're still dealing with long lead times of construction.
Well, first of all, we talked a little bit about this before we came on the air, but part of the construction cost problem that the U.S. had was we never built the same thing twice. And so not only were the reactor designs fairly unique, but almost every component in those plants was built on very low production volumes. So there was very little commonality, and everything got very expensive. One way to reduce the cost is to make it more common so that you can start using economies of mass production. One of the things that, in addition to running this wonderful podcast called The Atomic Show, I'm also the president founder of a little company called Adams Atomic Engines. And our concept is to reduce the construction costs by simplifying the design considerably, in that we use a high-temperature gas reactor with a direct-cycle Brayton-cycle gas turbine as the heat engine. So we get rid of a lot of very expensive components like pressure vessels.
Yeah, interesting.
The highest pressure in our system is only about 150 PSI.
Wow.
And we don't have a steam generator. We don't have pressurizers. We don't have canned coolant pumps. We have a containment vessel, but it's nowhere near as thick or as strong as a vessel that has to withstand the potential of a steam leak.
So, Rod, if you could go back in time to the early 1950s and write a memo to Admiral Rickover, would you say, don't have as much influence on the commercial power sector as you had, or the Navy had, because they, you know, they adopted basically the Navy's pressurized water reactor design?
Absolutely not. I wouldn't say that.
But you wouldn't do that. Okay.
The reason I wouldn't do that was because in the 1950s, when Admiral Rickover was doing his thing and designing his reactors and influencing the design of commercial reactors, Brayton-cycle gas turbines had very little operating history. The only ones that were available at that time were jet engines, and those were replaced about every few hundred hours on the jet airplanes that were flying in the 1950s. You know, we didn't have 30 years' worth of operating 707s and Spruance-class destroyers and Aegis-class cruisers and all the other things that we have today. We didn't have a situation where combustion turbines had been essentially the only power source being produced for central station power plants for 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what we've had in the U.S. The only large electric power plants built in the last 15 years have been Brayton cycle gas turbines powered by natural gas. You know, we haven't built any coal plants or nuclear plants in a long time.
Yeah.
So steam is not our technology, but in the 1950s, that was technology, that was the standard, and it made so much sense to go, we're developing this brand new heat source, let's not make it more complicated by making a whole new heat engine, too.
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you for the technology education. I didn't know that. It reminds me of that old TV show, James Burke, Connections. You know, he takes some little piece of technology and shows how, you know, we ended up with some modern technology through all these twists and turns.
Right.
Because of that, yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, the pressurized water reactor still has legs. If you have the resources to build gigantic steam turbines, and quite honestly, part of the reason we ended up with the reactor designs we did was not so much Rickover's design, because his designs were small and simple. the large, complicated ones were built by General Electric and Westinghouse, because that was one way to protect their market. Yeah. Nobody else could build the steam turbines associated with the large pressurized water reactors or boiling water reactors, except for those two.
Yeah, we went up, go back in the history, kind of 200 megawatt level, a huge leap up 1,000 megawatt level in a very short period of time.
Right, before we even had really operating history with a 200 megawatt reactor, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, we went from, like you said, Shippingport was a 60 megawatt reactor initially, eventually produced 100 megawatts, and that was 1957 when it came online.
Right.
And by 1967, we were building 1,000 megawatt reactors.
Yeah, incredible leap.
Yeah. So, you know, that scale up was maybe part of the issue, part of the cost issue. Part of the cost issue associated with the last generation, too, which, again, is a risk in today's world, is that they were built in an era of very high interest rates and high inflation, where I think for some of the ones that came online the latest, fully two-thirds of the total cost of the plant is interest cost.
Yes, right.
Interest during construction. And, you know, that's a huge economic problem.
Yeah, if you can keep the plant's cost somewhere close to overnight cost, and then the capital costs will be far more manageable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the economic studies that you quoted in your paper is one where I challenge people on. The MIT study in 2003, people keep pointing to that and saying, well, that proves that nuclear power can't really compete unless you have cost for carbon. But the assumptions in that study need to be made quite clear to people. First of all, the study assumes that a nuclear designer or nuclear builder is going to have to pay a higher interest rate than anybody else. Secondly, it assumes that the high-cost gas case, in other words, at that time in 2003 when they were doing the projections, they said, well, we're going to do a low-cost, a medium-cost, and a high-cost. The high cost for gas was $4.50 per million BTUs, with a maximum inflation rate of 2.5% per year.
Yeah.
Well, today...
Today it's higher than that.
Today natural gas costs $8 per million BTU.
Right, almost doubled, right.
So it's doubled.
Yeah.
And sometimes gas goes as high as $15 per million BTU. So that's another issue. The coal cost that they assume, $1.20 per million BTUs, but most coal plants pay more like $2.50 to $3 per million BTUs by the time you figure in the transportation costs.
And another thing, I mean, just to also criticize that study a bit more, they also, I think, even back 2003, they didn't quite see how much capital costs are going to go up for any power plant. The cost of concrete has gone up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's affecting not just nuclear plants, but coal plants, natural gas plants as well.
Sure. And siting problems, delays in construction, are going to affect coal as much as nuclear.
Right. I think is it Kansas where they're objecting to new coal plants?
In the last year, there have been 20 coal projects that have been canceled.
So, what are we going to do for more power? We might have to rethink the grid. I mean, I'm talking to some people saying, well, maybe the large power plants, whether they're coal, nuclear, what have you, maybe it could be a thing of the past, or we could have some mix in the future. We have more decentralized sources as well as the bigger baseload plants.
Yeah, the Adams engine starts at 10 megawatts.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's something that could provide power for a town.
Yeah, we like 10 megawatts as a start, but we see opportunities for 50 and 100 megawatt plants as well. And we also, quite honestly, have thoughts of very small reactors under a megawatt if we can get to the point where we can produce things in a factory on an assembly line and put them out the door as a finished product.
I don't know if you've had Professor Steve Fetter on your show, but he's a dear colleague of mine, and he's a strong supporter of these small reactors, especially even for the developing world. He said a lot of these countries don't need, you know, 100 megawatt, 200 megawatt, 1,000 megawatt systems. Mm-hmm. It's too big for them.
Right.
And he said you could design these reactors, so, you know, pretty simple, and you can make them pretty proliferation resistant, so it's going to be hard for some country to break in and grab the spent fuel and,
right.
and process plutonium. And Steve, though, he gets pushback from some of our colleagues in the non-proliferation community. I'm warming up to his idea, but I know others have not, so it might be interesting to get him on the show. He's at the University of Maryland, teaches at the School of Public Policy.
Mm-hmm.
And he has his doctorate in energy studies from Berkeley, and he has a physics. He was a physics major at MIT. So
you can send me his email address, and I
definitely
would like to
yeah.
to talk with him, because one of the things, and you having served in one of the grid disconnected reactors,
right? Yes,
can,
indeed, yes.
can understand this. If you go to developing countries. The transportation network is always stressed as it is, and imposing the burden of transporting fuel across that network as well is a challenge. If you could, you know, airdrop a reactor into the middle of a country and not have to have a train line to transport coal or trucks carrying oil or pipelines for natural gas, you could provide electricity, which is so nice to have.
Right, and we have, it's at least a billion people in the world who don't have electricity at all, and another billion who have very spotty access to electricity. So we're talking about a huge segment of humanity that has been shut out of,
right.
of what we consider an essential aspect of modern life.
And as we discussed a few minutes ago, the number of people with spotty access to electricity may be increasing.
Right.
I mean, South Africa right now
right.
has
yeah,
shut
the,
down.
The load shedding, yeah.
They've shut down gold mines.
That's right. Yeah, something that's extremely valuable to them for their economy.
Right.
Well,
I mean,
one of my colleagues is a South African. I was actually in Middlebury College last week, and that's why I couldn't be on the show last week. I was actually giving a public talk about nuclear energy in Vermont. Very appropriate state to talk about nuclear energy because they derive most electricity from Vermont Yankee.
Right.
And one of my colleagues who invited me to give the talk, he's South African, and he is opposed to nuclear weapons, but he's very supportive of nuclear energy. And he said, especially for South Africa, he said his relatives who are still living there, you know, they can go several hours a day without electricity.
Right. Yeah, I've got a very good colleague of mine, good friend of mine. He and his family just moved to South Africa to work on the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor project, the PBMR. And he's sending me reports from the area talking about how tough it is to live in a place where the power goes out for a couple hours at a time.
Well, speaking of a pebble bed, my colleague said, well, what's going on with that? I mean, that's a reactor system that's very safe.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it just doesn't seem to really be getting traction. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just set to take off.
Oh, it's getting traction. It just
okay.
is. It takes a long time to build something brand new, and particularly in a technology where every step is fought by the competition.
Right.
You know, I like to remind people, and I'm a broken record. So for those of you who are listening and say, "Ah, Rod's going to go off again." People in the nuclear world have seemed to forget. They like to blame, quote, the environmentalists. But the real opposition, the people with means, motive, and opportunity to hamper the expansion of nuclear power, are those who sell competitive sources of power. Coal, oil, and natural gas
yeah.
producers have a huge economic incentive for dissing nuclear power. For spreading what the technological term is FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt about a competition. Okay, people talk about, oh, nuclear is a terrorist target. By historical standards, coal, oil, and gas are far larger targets for terrorists, that they continue to be attacked on a regular basis, and people die from the attacks, and economies get disrupted and everything else. Yet nobody really attacks nuclear facilities because they're pretty hard.
Yeah, and it's the symbol. It's nuclear, and
But why are we so afraid of nuclear?
I don't know.
We've been taught to be afraid.
Right.
There's an old song. You have to be taught to fear. Right.
Yeah.
I think they sang that on The King and I or something. No, you have to be taught to hate. I don't know what it is.
Right, but still, I mean, it's like people aren't born with that kind of fear. I mean, it's something that they learn, they acquire.
Yeah, the refrain is, you have to be carefully taught. And I can't sing, so. Hey, Charles, you know, this has been a lot of fun, but my clock says that we've been talking for over an hour. So.
Okay, and it's been pretty wide-ranging, so hopefully people who will listen in on this will learn something.
Yeah, but we have patient listeners, so they put it on in their iPods and turn it on for their commute into work. So this may be a two-tripper, but I hope
you and if I could help you identify colleagues who might want to be on the show, I'd be happy to do that.
I would love it, and certainly since I live in the local area, I would love to have the opportunity to come and talk to some of your colleagues, because there's a lot of things to discuss, a lot of mind-opening that can be achieved, I think, through continued conversation and sharing of ideas.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate your time. Hope that you have a good rest of the week, and thank you very much.
And thank you very much. Good luck with your show.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. Ooh, there's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.